I often end this particular talk that I want to offer with this poem, but I'm going to begin with it. Talk backwards. And maybe I'll have a Zoom meeting at the same time. Yeah, Mary, you say, hey, maybe you can do some emails while you're talking. Yeah. So, there's an American Palestinian poet named Naomi Shihab Nye, and in the 1980s, she was married, and her husband, as a honeymoon journey, decided to travel from Austin, Texas, where they were living at the time, to the end of South America. And so they went by train and bus and different things, and they were traveling along. And in Colombia, their bus was pulled over by some militia. As you may know, Colombia has had a lot of unrest for many years, over 50 years before a peace treaty was signed. And in the 1980s, with the narcotics and different militias, insurgency, it was a very, it potentially could be a dangerous place. And unfortunately, their bus got pulled over and they were all robbed of their money and passports. There was actually a passenger that was shot and killed. It was a very violent experience. And I'm sorry to bring that in here now with that image, but there's, I trust, something that you'll find that will also touch your heart. And so after this experience, they walked into a small village and they were met by an old and very kind man. And he helped them to figure out what to do, as far as they'll have, one of them will have to travel, or both of them will have to travel to a bigger city, Cali, and get money wired and work on getting a passport. But it was decided that Naomi would stay in this village, and that old man and others would just kind of look after her, and the husband went off to Cali. And Naomi said, I heard her give this talk about this poem. She said, you know, I went inside this small, this village plaza outside, and I sat on a bench, and I got out my pen and paper. And then this is what was written, is what I will share with you. And she'll say, she says firsthand, she says, I did not write this poem. I did not write it. I was a scribe. I just wrote down what the universe or the mystery told me to write. So she wrote down what she was told. So she often claims that I didn't write this, I was a scribe. But this is what she wrote. It's called kindness. She says, before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things and feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. And what you held in your hand and what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. So you know how desolate the landscapes can be between the regions of kindness, and how you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop and the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out those windows forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where an Indian in a white poncho lies dead on the side of the road, and you must see how this could be you. And how that he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing, and you must wake up with sorrow and speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of that cloth. And then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. It's only kindness that ties your shoes, that sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. It is only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for. And then it goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. I so deeply resonate with her heart, these words. It is only kindness that makes sense anymore when you've seen so much pain. And to me, the teachings of the Dharma are a teaching of kindness. So it was even said that Ananda was found crying in the forest after the Buddha's death. And supposedly he was saying over and over again about the Buddha as he wept, he was just so kind. He was just so kind. He was just so kind. Only kindness that makes sense anymore. And it feels like these teachings are a legacy of kindness, and they're a living teaching, not just in books, but they lived, passed in the forest from one generation to the next, into the cities, passed along. When I think of my benefactor teachers, Dr. Rina Sirkar, Thampu Lucero, Laintit Sero, Pakoku Sero, it was a legacy of kindness, no doubt very wise in the Dharma. The kindness, legacy of the heart, the legacy of wisdom. And to me, this practice boils down to awareness and love, mindfulness, metta, compassion, runa. And I'll just share with you an aspiration that I have, a sincere one. It gnaws on me. It informs me. Guides me. That is this aspiration to make peace. To reconcile that by the time that I'm on my deathbed, that I'll have made peace with myself, this life, and the world. And because I have such an aspiration, it reveals to me that I have a lot of work to do. And it's partially joking, but it's like, you know, as if I have this book of everybody who has kind of ticked me off since I was born. And it's a very big book, very small font, many volumes. Just look at me funny, you get in the book. Such is narcissism and egocentricity. To make peace. To me, that'd be, I mean, no doubt attaining nibbana would also be a crowning achievement, but if that's not there, how about making a little more peace? And so I've kind of, and along with my beloved dear companion wife, Jan, we actually do retreats with this at times and different things on reconciliation and have identified four particular areas that feel very important, that are interrelated. And I'd like to just speak about them. And so the first area of reconciliation, and you know, it's interesting with words. I mean, it could be reconciliation. For some, it might be better to use forgiveness. For others, it might be making amends or making peace. So whatever word translates for you that is not activating, you're welcome to use. But here I'm going to use the word reconcile or make amends. But the first is to reconcile to the times that I've been hard on myself. The second is reconciling to the times I've hurt others. The third is reconciling to those that have hurt me. The fourth was something that developed later, but it's reconciling or making peace with the life that I got. So I'd like to speak about these. I'll begin with this reconciling about oneself. And, you know, born out of our conditioning, it's developed the sense of our identity, our belief, our stories, our narratives that were developed very early. We may have beliefs of our inadequacy, our deficiency. I spoke about that the other day. Feeling that you're damaged goods, you're not going to amount to anything, and so forth. Born out of this conditioning. And again, as I mentioned the other day, like, we didn't come in this way. We had somewhat of a fairly clean slate, and it gets molded and shaped by our experience. And often, very sadly, due to times we came in with a very sovereign way, we didn't care what other people think, and we were full of our just being ourselves, and gradually we may be shamed. We may be made to feel small, humiliated. And these type of things, we begin to lose that sense of our own sovereignty. We begin to develop a dialogue of just what a bad person I am. I'll never forget, I'm going to use some crude language, so I'll give you a little warning. I was teaching an MBSR class a number of years ago, and we were going around the circle. People were checking in on how they were doing, what they were learning. And this woman that I would have said some years ago, an older woman, well, probably a person around my age now, she shared that that she had this awareness during the week as she was meditating that in her entire adult life, she did not remember one day that she didn't call herself, sorry, here's the warning, X-rated, she called herself, well, actually not X-rated, just a swear, an asshole. And it was kind of shocking. Like, this woman calls herself that every day. And another person said, well, I don't call myself that, but I call myself a dummy. And another person said, well, I don't call myself that, I call myself stupid. And it was like going around the circles, like, wow. What we say to ourselves is silent and vicious. It's silent and vicious. So much so that actually, if we ever said to others, our family, our friends, what we say to ourselves, we wouldn't have any friends. Would you treat a friend the way at times we treat ourselves with our own internal dialogues? Where did we learn this? This was learned. We didn't come in this way. This is the gift of the Dharma. What is learned can potentially begin to be unlearned. At least now I see it. This is why awareness. This is why my teacher Tempu Lucero used to say, if you know that greed is arising, he would actually go through each of the five senses in the mind. And he had this kind of poetic way, and I won't do it the way that he did it now because it's kind of long. But he would say, like, if you know that greed or hatred or ignorance, but he'd do each one individually. If you know that greed is arising in your eyes or your nose or your tongue or your ears, if you know it, the main point, if you know it, you're gaining knowledge. If you don't know, you're accumulating ignorance. It's a very profound, very simple teaching. So even if you're aware and know that greed is arising, that is knowledge. If you didn't know it, around and around you go. So the knowing will bring us, in time, deeper wisdom. And so when we don't know, it's the self-referencing that goes round and around. Carl Jung has this very powerful reading. He says, you know, I can feed the hungry, I can forgive an insult, I can love my enemies, and these are great virtues, but what if I should discover that the poorest of the beggars, the most impudent of the offenders, are all within me? And that I stand in the need of the alms of my own kindness. that I myself am the enemy who must be loved. That I stand in the need of the alms of my own kindness, that I myself am the enemy who must be loved. Sometimes we need help to help us to remember. Perhaps due to such strong identifications, and for many of us, these identifications are so strong, we believe. It's almost as if there's been a court case, there's been a jury, and you have been condemned with a life sentence of your unworthiness. And it is so strong and believed that sometimes people can do dire things with these beliefs. But we're here to investigate, is that really true? Sometimes we need help. Help within our own practice to begin to see these stories that we're telling ourselves that we've identified with and see that it is a story, it is a narrative. And that one that actually becomes aware and knows that it's a story, that it's a narrative, that it's a belief, that it's an identification, the one that knows that is a little bit wisdom growing here. The one that knows is beginning to see the stories and the narratives and perhaps can get a little bit unbinded from it, disentangled from it. And then like our good friends that may be here to help remind us, in Galway Canal has this beautiful poem called St. Francis and the Sow. And he says that the bud stands for all things and even for the things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing, though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness. That's what I'm here to do, to remind you all, to reteach, to remind us all of our own loveliness, the wakefulness, the Buddha nature is within us. Sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on the brow of a flower and retell it in words and touch that it is lovely, until it begins to flower from within of its own blessing. Just as St. Francis put his hand on the creased forehead of the sow and told her in words and in touch blessings. Blessings on the sow. And that sow began remembering. She began to remember all down her thick length from her earthen snout and all the way through the fauda and slops to the spiritual curl of her tail, from the hard spininess spiked out from the spine and down through the great heart to the sheer blue milk and dreaminess spurting and shuddering from the 14 teats in the 14 mouths, sucking and blowing beneath them the long, perfect loveliness of a sow, of a mama sow. Sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness. The Dharma's here to awaken you. I don't know if I shared this earlier, so I'll just ask that this was about a Zen teacher I had, Bishop Nipu Sayaku. And this is from many years ago, and he was really into what's called the Nagarjuna's Majjhima Karika, which is a very particular form of Zen non-duality. And he used to say to me quite often, Bob, you are the stupidest person I've ever met in my entire life. Now, that's kind of a very assaulting type of thing to do, but he would say it with a smile on his face. And I was his student, and we had a relationship, so it wasn't abuse. And we had this little skit. So he would say, I'm the stupidest person. And I'd say, why am I so stupid? And he'd say, because you're already enlightened, but you just don't know it. And we would do this often, so I'd hear him often say that. And to be very honest, as the years have gone by, Like sometimes it's necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness. Like I've begun as the years have gone by, like he really meant it. Not that I was stupid, but that there was already awakening inside me. He could see that even though it's been totally obscured to me. He could see inside me this bright light of possibility. I give deep thanks to Bishop Nipusiaku. I don't think he'll have known how much he touched me. Yeah, he used to say everything's just an illusion. And then one day my other teacher, Dr. Rina Sarkar, took his paycheck out of the faculty box at the California Institute of Asian Studies where he's going to school. And he's looking around, where's my paycheck? And Rina's holding, saying, it's all just an illusion. And he said, yes, you're very naughty, Rina. You're very naughty. Give me that check. Yeah. Sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness. Making peace to the times we've been hard on ourselves. And this didn't come out of nowhere. This came out of us being hurt, smashed, humiliated, shamed. And when we think about personality development, this is happening at an age that we don't even know this is happening because it's part of our developmental stages. Early, early in life, this is being formed and developed. Develop this identity, again, filled with self-referencing. And now we're learning about self-awareness that potentially can begin to break the cycle of self-referencing. So this is a deep work, this sense of making peace to the times we've been hard on ourselves, born out of this conditioned mind that believes otherwise. So this is a very important endeavor. As Derek Walcott says in his poem, Love After Love, the time will come and with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door and in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome. And you will love again the stranger who is yourself, giving back your heart to itself. This is a powerful practice of beginning to make peace, a practice to begin to see these stories, these narratives, these conditionings, these identifications, these beliefs, and like, oh, this is something that I carry. Perhaps if you've been afraid to sing that song, you can go out in the woods tonight and sing that song. You can draw that painting. You can skip. You can find your own heart, regaining our sovereignty. It's so important in parenting, accepting our child, having empathy, supporting them to grow with greater confidence that I had mentioned. And so the second area that I want to bring up is about reconciling to the times that I've caused pain to another. This is a very humbling practice, and for many, we may not like to want to admit, to acknowledge that we have been a difficult one for another, that we've caused pain to another. And again, born out of the sense of conditioning, born out of the sense of perhaps in times that have caused some pain to another, I was not as aware as I was now. Sometimes I like to call this hindsight wisdom. We look back and we can understand more about where we were then, what was going on, perhaps bringing greater understanding to that time and to begin to reconcile. This is a difficult practice. To reconcile is actually beginning to reconcile with yourself, to forgiving yourself, understanding where you were then. Maybe hold it with compassion. May it also inform you today and in the future, because of what you have learned that has caused pain, that you do your best to try not to repeat it again. In the Dharma, there's a very poetic expression for this. It's called becoming a guardian of the world, a protector. That we learn from what we had done that caused pain to another, and we do our best not only to say, I'm sorry, but to actually change your ways so that you, as much as possible, don't do it again. There's been times as a father, I wasn't being the father that I really wanted to be, and I'd hurt my son's feelings, and I'd recognize it, and I'd come back, and I'd apologize. A genuine apology. And then I would also just, Bob, remember this. Remember. So I don't do it again. Because it's one thing to keep on saying sorry and keep on doing the action. Then the sorry doesn't mean anything. But to say I'm sorry and to actually make a change because of it, that earns back trust. You've got to earn it. It's not just lip service. It's got to be earned through our actions. There's some powerful stories of reconciliation and becoming a guardian of the world. And there's actually an ancient Buddhist story of Angulimala, which means the collector of a garland of thumbs. And he was not such a nice guy. He'd kill people and cut off their thumbs and put them in a nice little necklace. And he had just one thumb more to go, or two thumbs more to go, and said, I want to get this necklace done. And happened to see the Buddha down the road and said, oh, cutting the Buddha's thumbs, that would be a score. And so I'm going to go kill the Buddha and then get his thumbs. And the Buddha was walking, and with his powers, he could sense what Angulimala was going to do, and then he performed a supernormal power where Angulimala started walking towards the Buddha, but the Buddha continued to be the same distance away. And then he started to trot, and the Buddha was the same distance away. And then he started to run and to sprint and trying to, I'm going to get him now, and finally collapsed to the ground because the Buddha was just as far away. And then finally, Angulimala, like breathing heavily and lying on the ground, heard some footsteps, and that was the Buddha. And the Buddha said, hey, what you doing? This is not the path to peace. And one of these amazing stories, Angulimala waked up right on the spot. And he said, could you make me a monk? And in those days, to become a monk was a very quick ritual. It was two words, ehi bhikkhu. That means come monk. And now Angulimala was a monk. And of course, he had not a very good reputation around. And when people would see him, they would throw stones at him and, try to stay away from him. And of course, since he was a monk with the Buddha, they didn't, it was a complex situation. And one day, Angulimala was on an alms round collecting food, and people give him the worst food, but his practice was not to complain, to receive. He knew with deep remorse the type of life he had lived before. And he heard some person crying and yelling out for help, and he walked over, and it was a woman, and she was pregnant, and she was actually in labor, and she calls out to him, help me, can you help me? And then Angulimala, I don't know what to do. I'm going to go run and ask the Buddha what to do. So he ran and came up to the Buddha pretty quickly, and he explained very quickly to the Buddha what was going on, and the Buddha said, you can help her, just tell her what's true. And then he started running, he said, thank you, and he starts running back, and he goes, tell her what's true? What are you talking about? Tell her what's true? What's true? And so he was just struggling and running, but he said, tell us true, tell us true, tell us true. And so finally he came to her, and all of a sudden something came to him. It was just cry. Like he said, by the power of the truth that I have not harmed any living being since wearing these noble robes, and by the power of this truth, may you give birth healthily for the baby and for you. And he said this three times, and then the woman gave birth. And it's a very, this is recorded in what's called the Angulimala Sutta, and the monastics will actually chant this for women, for families that are pregnant, that are going to be giving birth. When my two sons were pregnant, when my wife was pregnant with my our two sons, we went to the monastery, and the monastics chanted the Angulimala Sutta for her for protection. But what the story, like, not only this, the speaking about the power of truth, but Angulimala became a guardian of the world. And the power of truth, that I have not harmed any living being with noble robes as a monk. Another person that I just want to share that to me also is a modern day Angulimala is a Zen priest, and his name is Claude Shin Thomas. And in he grew up and was a soldier in Vietnam. And he came from a family of soldiers, and he knew that when he enlisted, and he was going to be a soldier too. And he's quite frank and blunt. And he'll say, I heard him give this talk about this, and he said, you know, my job working for the U.S. government was to kill people. And I was really good at it. And he happened to be a machine gunner in Vietnam. And, you know, after a mission, if you get, whoever gets the most kills gets a bag of heroin, gets some other drugs or whatever. And he said, I won a lot of those bets. And by the end of the war, this is very dramatic, he had killed over 350 men, women, and children. And after the war, he became a drug addict. He was homeless, living outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and just lost, traumatized. And a social worker saw something in him out on the streets and would come to visit him, bring him food, tell him about, you know, to help him to try to get off drugs, but he wasn't interested at the time. But she just took a liking to him, saw something in him. And as time went on, she came to him and said, you know, there's this retreat I really want you to go to. And he said, no, I'm not going to go. But then she'd come back a little later, there's this retreat I really want you to go. No, I'm not going to go. Well, this went on and on and on. And Claude said that she was such a pain in the ass that I finally said, okay, I'm going to go. Just so that she wouldn't ask me anymore. And so he went to this retreat, and it was a retreat with fellow Vietnam veterans, and the teacher was Thich Nhat Hanh. He was dedicating this time to help serve the soldiers that he knew were so traumatized. And this changed his life, and he began to meditate. He entered into recovery, to rehab, and practicing sincerely. And you know, Thich Nhat Hanh left for other things, and he got involved with the Zen Peacemaker Order with a Zen teacher named Bernie Glassman. That he's quite. He would hold many different types of retreats, even including like going to Europe and working with survivors from concentration camps and children from SS and Nazi, and bringing them together during retreats. He was quite outrageous and amazing. And he became a student of Bernie Glassman. And he got very into the practice. And there came a time where then he asked Bernie if he could ordain as a Buddhist monk. And Bernie thought about it for some time and said, all right, I'm going to ordain you, but we're going to go to a particular place. And so they flew to Poland, and they came to the train station and platform at Auschwitz, where people were pointed to go to the concentration camp or to the gas chambers. And on that train platform, they ordained him as a Buddhist monk. And Claudia Chin Thomas has a little sense of humor. He says, then I took a left and I began to walk. He said, I walked for 1.5 years from Auschwitz overland to Saigon and Vietnam. And everywhere he went, anyone that would listen to him, he would tell his own personal story. It's actually written in a book called Hell's Gate, at Hell's Gate. But he goes to war zones, prisons, inner city, wherever. And he travels and he tells his story. When I was in Colombia a few years ago, my host had him come a couple of years earlier to do peace work in Colombia. It's an outrageous story. When I met him, I bowed to him afterwards. I said, you're a modern-day Angulimala. Like how he, you know, from this place of such trauma and agony, and he lives with every day. You can see in his nervous system what it's like to have done what he's done. And that the only thing that he can do to survive is tell anyone that will listen to him what it is that he has done. That's how he has to live, because of the pain that he's endured and caused to so many people. He's a guardian of the world. And it gives me inspiration that if he can do that, well, you know, I haven't done what he's done. I got my own list. But that it's possible to honor that forgiveness, that apology, but also really learning from it and not repeating it again in our own lives. Making peace to the times that I have caused pain to another. And it's important, again, to understand, you know, where we were then and what was going on in our lives, the conditioning that we were living with, the fears, the woundedness. Now I'm understanding more. Can I reach back to that person that was so scared, sad, unaware, and with heart to meet them? Third area is making peace to those that have hurt me. This is very, very difficult. So perhaps a way that we can approach this is in the service of our own preservation, even more so our well-being, to begin to lessen, dissolve, neutralize any resentments and grudges that we harbor in our hearts. And this is not easy. Might be impossible to forgive or reconcile to someone that's hurt you, but also, so long as we continue to harbor resentment and grudges and ill will and so forth towards another, we will continue to suffer. There's just no doubt about that. When Jan and I, my partner and I, we a few years ago traveled to Colombia and we taught a retreat there. And our friend who was our host, we were in Bogota. And she said, I want to show you both something. But she says, I'm not going to tell you what it is. And so we were walking in some district in the center of the city in Bogota, and then we came across this, like a shell of a building on the four, surrounding the four sides of it. But inside the shell, it was just like maybe really like a wall or something. Inside was a fairly new building with a lot of windows and a black floor. And so we said to her, what's this? She goes, I'm not going to tell you anything. Just come with me. And it's also in silence. Be silent. So, okay. Then had no idea what we were, where we were going and what we were doing. And so we walk in and there's just this big black floor. and just pretty open. There was one little center room that you could walk into that had a video playing. But in the meantime, we just walked around this black floor and still had no idea what was going on. And then eventually we went into this little room with this video playing, and there was an artist, her name was Doris Solidio. And the name of this, it's an exhibit, it's called Fragmentos. And the video explains that I mentioned to you earlier that there was over 50 years of war and conflict in Colombia. There's still some insurgency there, but it's much better. And there was a peace treaty signed some years ago that was historic. The different factions and militias and narcos and so forth and government. And there was a peace treaty signed. And part of the agreement of the peace treaty was that everyone was going to donate their guns to be melted. And so this video shows this story of all of these guns being transported, and they were melted, and then they were poured into plates about 1 meter square. And then Doris got many women and some men that were victims of these years of conflict to help in the art project. And there's these huge tables, and they had mallets, and they were banging and banging these plates to help get them in such a way that they could be fastened to the floor. And many of these people were interviewed, and some were saying, I have held so much anger and hatred, and it's destroying me, it is killing me, and I can't live with it anymore. And like one after another was banging and talking about this. I can't live with this resentment. I can't live with these grudges. That black floor I was walking on was made of guns. And so powerful to see those people expressing, like, they've been living with this resentment and rage and anger for so long, it's taking them down. They can't live this way anymore. Beginning to reconcile to those that hurt me. This is a huge practice. If you go on YouTube and if you put in the word fragmentos, it'll show you like about a 5-minute video of this project. And it's making peace to those that have hurt me. It's very interesting. Norman Fisher, who's a Zen priest, poet, writer, he wrote a Buddhist-inspired translation from the Old Testament book of Psalms. And a lot of the Old Testament, not all of it, but a lot of it has pretty descriptive language of bad people, as that they're wicked, they're bad, they're evil, they're unrighteous, you know, strong language. And Norman very cleverly erased all of those words and retranslated it as they were heedless, they were not mindful, they were not aware. And I think that was such, that is a real wisdom. Like born out of unawareness, and the beginning of dependent origination, the first thing is unawareness. And this is this cyclic change, a chain of reactivity. When this happens, that is like dominoes. When this happens, that happens, that happens, this happens. And the beginning is ignorance. That's why even in the cause of suffering begins with ignorance. Then leads to misconception, that leads to grasping and aversion, but it's ignorance. That's why my teacher used to say, darkest of all is ignorance, is not knowing. Darkest of all is ignorance. The Sadhu used to say, again, this is kind of a funny example, but he would say, who's worse? Someone that's not killing people or someone that is killing people? Or no, he would say, that's what he said, who is worse? And so obviously he'd say, who's worse is the person killing people. But he said, no, actually, the one that knows that they're killing will eventually stop, but the one that doesn't know will kill forevermore. So again, this coming back to like, if you know, eventually it's going to change you. But if you don't know, You go around and around. I remember as a kid, like, I didn't know. I'm sorry, I've taken out many ants. I feel bad about it now. That's why, and maybe that's because of that. I don't try to harm one single creature as much as possible. But that unawareness is just oblivious. Or going up, like getting a fly swatter, boom, you're dead. Doing this spider, bam, you're there. Like there's just no awareness, just boom, boom, boom. But now, like, I'm more aware of the of sentient life and how sacred it is in my own life and my kids' life. And like, oh, maybe they don't want to get hurt either. But when I was unaware, I didn't have a clue. Not one clue. And speaking of this awareness, I just want to tell you one other just amazing story. This maybe goes more with making peace to those I've hurt. But a few years ago, there was, I believe it was at Standing Rock in North Dakota. There's a big pipeline going through, and this was going to go through some very sacred Sioux First Nation land. And there was a big controversy about this, some of you may remember. And Wes Clark was the chief commander for NATO for some years, and he had a son who was Wes Clark Jr. And Wes Clark Jr. was a retired lieutenant, and he had read about this situation in Standing Rock and really recognized this is really wrong. And the story goes, he invited 2,000 of his vet friends and colleagues, all in motorcycles. They drove to Standing Rock, and they created a human shield around these bulldozers. They stopped it. And then, and it's again on a YouTube video, it's like this most, it doesn't repay everything of what's been devastated with the Native Americans, but it was a good gesture that he came to the Lekchi, Leonard Crow Dog, chief of the Great Sioux Nation. And he came to him and he got his body and head on the dirt, completely on the dirt, and he asked forgiveness. Forgiveness, because in that place, they were involved with the U.S. military with many massacres, particularly one that was devastating on June 25th, 1876. And so again, these possibilities that we could begin gestures towards peace, towards reparation, towards, I'm sorry, and we'll try to do something. The last area is making peace to the life I got. And actually, I appreciate some of the teachings. It's like this. This is the life that I got. Like, I happened to be born in this body with this color skin with whatever it is that I have in my life. And, you know, like, but so much times in our life, I want it to be different. Like, I had a lot of curly hair growing up and I wanted straight hair. Now I got no hair. And some of us had straight hair and really wanted curly hair. And some of us wanted to be tall and we were short. Some of us were short and wanted to be, like not being happy with the body, not being happy this and that and that and this. And, of course, there is room for us all to grow towards our goal, our dreams, and to reach towards the stars and do whatever we want to do. But also, at the same time, how do we also reconcile with the life that we have? That, yeah, I'm probably not going to be the lead singer for the Rolling Stones, or, well, actually, more like the Grateful Dead. I'm more of a Grateful Dead head than a Rolling Stone guy. But I'm not going to be starring, winning an Academy Award, and, I'm not going to be the president. And, there's like a lot of things. It's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. Not going to be Mary Grace Orr or Yasmina. Or JD, I'm not going to be Jack Cornfield. I'm going to be me. But how much of the time have we left ourselves wanting to be someone else? somehow projecting that somehow they or this group is better, and if I'm just a part of it, if I'm then I'll be okay. How do we begin to make peace with the life, with my lot in life? And potentially, there's some gratefulness. Many years ago, I was in India in Pondicherry. I was there for a few weeks, maybe a month. And I became kind of friendly with a beggar that lived on the corner. He was a midget. And he would never ask for money. But when I would walk by, he was very busy streets. He lived on this corner. He had a little cardboard hut there. And I just see him every day. That's where he lived. That's what he did. But when we went by him, if you looked at him, he'd look at you and he'd have the most beautiful smile. And I was very touched with him. And I kind of look forward to going down. I'm going to go see him. And some years later, I was now living in California, but I had some friends that had come back from Pondicherry, and I asked them about the beggar. How's he doing? He said, oh, he died a few years ago. Like, oh. But then my friend said, there's an amazing story about him. Oh, what happened? Goes, well, it turns out that he saved every single rupee that was ever offered to him, and they found him dead in his little cardboard thing, and there was a little note that said, buried underneath a whole bunch of stuff, there was a box with... He says, please, I grew up on the streets. I didn't even have an orphanage. Let this be a dana to make an orphanage. I can still see his face now. There's saints that are around. We have a local Saint Curtis in Santa Cruz with a big red truck and speakers that are so loud it'll break your eardrums. And his whole dharma is collecting what everybody wants, food and clothing and shelters, and then he drives to the Hopi Reservation, he drives to the Navajo Reservation, he used to go in the early years to New Orleans when the hurricane came, and his whole dharma is service. There's saints to be found. My wife tells a story of when, like, she was at Safeway on Morrissey here, and she was in, you know, sometimes you go to the store, you want to get in the quickest line, and she thought she entered in the quickest line, but it wasn't. It's one of these lines from hell, I'm never going to get out of here. And like, but then she said, well, should I go in another line? But then I might lose my spot. And like, so she ended up being in that line, and she was getting increasingly kind of irritated. But then finally, she gets closer to the checker. And with each person, the checker's stopping, and he's going, how you doing, ma'am or sir or they or them? How you doing? And he had this whole gesture. It was like a bow. And then she was like, oh, my God, there's a saint in Safeway. And then she said for the future, she would always go to that line. She always wanted to go to this person. In the Morrissey post office, I love this one guy. I like to go to him because it's like getting darshan. You know, it's like darshan. Like there's saints amongst us, but maybe we don't see them. Maybe we're saintly in the sense that we see someone and we offer a moment of kindness, of dignity. I try as a practice that no matter a homeless person, if I walk by and there's lots of them, I'm so sad in Santa Cruz, but I'll try to establish eye contact. I see you. Connect, making peace with our hearts, with this life. May we never underestimate these powers of love. Love is, I believe, one of the most powerful forces in the universe. And I love these words from Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He says the ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Through violence, you may murder the hater, but you do not murder hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. I love this. I love what he just said, but I love what he says here too. He goes, and I have to say that I have decided to stick to love. I have decided to stick to love. I know that love is the ultimate, the only answer to the problems of humanity. I say to myself that hate is too great of a burden to bear. I have decided to stick to love. And if you're seeking the highest good, I think you can find it through love. May we never underestimate these powers of love. And there's actually a Pali term called metta-citta vimutti, the liberation of the mind and heart through loving kindness. Metta-citta vimutti, the liberation of the heart through loving kindness. And why is that? Because it dissolves narcissism, egocentricity, self-centeredness, opens the heart. So may we remember. May we remember this heart, this life, this shared humanity, this shared world, this shared universe. May we remember. So I'll end with a reading called Remember. I love this poem so much. It's from Joy Harjo. J.D. had read another poem of hers earlier, Native American poet laureate. Remember. Remember the sky you were born under. Know each of the stars' stories. Remember the moon and know who she is. Remember the sun's birth at dawn. That is the strongest point of time. Remember sundown and the giving away tonight. Remember your birth and how your mother struggled to give you form and breath. You are the evidence of her life and her mother's and hers. Remember your father, he is your life also. Remember the earth whose skin you are. Red earth, black earth, yellow earth, white earth, brown earth. We are all earth. Remember the plants, trees, animal life, who all have their tribes, their families, their histories too, and talk to them. Listen to them. They are alive poems. Remember the wind. Remember her voice. She knows the origin of this universe. Remember you are all people and all people are you. Remember you are this universe and this universe is you. Remember all is in motion, is growing, is you. Remember language comes from this. Remember the dance language is that life is. Remember. Remember the earth whose skin you are. Red earth, black earth, yellow earth, white earth, brown earth. We are all earth. Remember, you are all people, and all people are you. Remember, you are this universe, and this universe is you. remember. 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 So may we remember, remembering into our skin, muscle, connective tissue, bone, marrow, organs, and being. May we remember.